Okay, why animals? Well, there are all sorts of reasons why human beings are interested in animals, and I'll just skim through them briefly. One of them is, of course, that we live with animals and interact with animals. And one of the, one of the points I want to talk about in a minute is the difference, the way in which we have actually in some ways become alienated from animals and the effects of that on the way that we think animals. But if you imagine yourself in Amazonia, where I work, life consists, you fell a very small area of forest and you make a little house in the middle, and you are constantly impressed by the fact that the difference between human society and the rest of the engulfing nature is very, very small indeed. And you rely upon animals constantly. These people are not people who keep pet animals. They're not people who eat domestic animals. They think eating domestic animals is an obscenity. So these people are hunters who are in constant interaction with animals, and they know animals extremely well. And if you listen to them talk, one of the things that you find is that they are very ready to adopt the perspective of animals. They know animals so well that they see themselves as being mirrored in the animal world, so that you get hunters coming back and telling stories about the fact that they, for instance, they meet a jaguar in the forest, and they describe the whole scene from the jaguar's perspective. And in the world of jaguars, human beings, if you were a jaguar and you think as in the world of jaguars, from the perspective of a jaguar, it's jaguars who are people and people who are jaguars. So that these hunters describe, they come across a jaguar and the hunter says, I saw a jaguar and I was really frightened. But sometimes they tell it from the jaguar's perspective, and they say, I, as a jaguar, saw a human being, jaguar, coming to kill me. In other words, they're switching perspectives. And they will tell you, for instance, that in the world of that vultures see, if you were a vulture, you would see a rotting deer as a lake full of fish. And what are the fish? Well, of course, the fish are maggots. So that they're able to take the perspective of other people. So that's one of the other animals. And that we see, here's a little extract from a tiny extract from a poem by D.H. Lawrence called A Doe at Evening. And here's Lawrence, he says, I looked at her and felt her watching. I became a strange being. So here's Lawrence adopting, here's Lawrence in a poetic mode, adopting this same mode of perspectival thinking that we find very commonly in Amazonian shamanism. And one of the consequences of the Amazonian take is that if for animals, being an animal is being effectively a human person, then hunting is effectively warfare. Because if all creatures are, from their own perspective, persons, then eating meat is thoroughly dangerous, not because Amazonian Indians feel compassion for animals, but simply because it is through eating meat that the animals might take revenge. So that's one point about animals, is that we in various ways can see them as mirrors of ourselves and empathize with them and understand that they too might look at us as if we were animals. The second point is that, and as an extension of this, animals are obviously both the same as us, but also very different from us. They're the same in that they're warm-blooded, sentient, mortal, etc. They move around. But at the same time, they're either less than we are, so that we call them brute animals, beasts, etc., which is to take a superior position, or sometimes we perceive them as morally superior or physically superior, so that we have a very common, worldwide common idea that, for instance, birds are like spirits and spirits are superior to humans, so that we get that in Christianity, the dove is obviously a spirit in this sense. So that they're, on the one hand, dumb animals, but on the other hand, they have quite extraordinary capacities, which we don't. They can fly and swim underwater, etc. And the third point is that animals offer us an image of both similarity and difference. They represent, in abstract, a taxonomic system which we can use. So that if we start with mammals, There's a sense in which all mammals are the same, but of course then we have different mammals. We have ungulates, we have carnivores, etc. And then we can subdivide the carnivores, etc. So that animals provide a ready-made schema of similarity and difference, which is exactly how we perceive our own social world. Our own social world is an endlessly nested experience of similarity and difference. I'm different from you, my family is different, we're same within our families, but different from outsiders, we're same within our neighborhoods, but different from others, etc. So that we experience this constant experience of similarity and difference, and we might use animals to signal that in various ways. And I want to show in a moment how people have discussed the phenomenon of what is called totemism, and I want to contrast two theories of totemism, one by Durkheim and one by Levi-Strauss. And you will see that Levi-Strauss in particular picks up this idea as animals as a ready-made set of tokens with which we can think about ourselves. In other words, we can conclude then that animals suggest a mode of thought, and it's pretty obvious in both for logical obvious reasons, but also in terms of the archaeological record, that animals are one of the three prime and prior, they're the three baseline symbolic systems. Animals, because as I say, they are part of us, but also outside us. So if we look at cave art, what do we find? The first bits of obvious representation are animals. The second very obvious symbolic system is our own bodies, which represent another model of difference, similarity, space, time, etc. And the third one is the houses in which we live, which in some ways we can see as an extension of our bodies. And in that case, we can map things onto space. And in conclusion, we can say that this system of animal symbolism is really operating on two axes, one of which is the axis of metaphor, that animals are in some senses like us and in some senses different from us. So that if, for instance, I say that Bush is a hawk, what I mean is that there are some aspects of Bush which are hawk-like, or if somebody else might be described as a dove, ditto. I don't mean literally these things, so I'm speaking metaphor, and we do that a great deal with animals. And also the distinction, the metaphorical relation between us and animals, that they're like us but also different from us, can also be mapped onto all sorts of other things, like the distinction between mind and body, or friend and enemy, the living and the dead, etc. So that it's very, very common in parts of the tribal world that the relationship between humans and animals is exactly the relationship between the living and the dead. That animals are ancestors, and also the animals are what you become when you die, and also where human spirits or where babies come from. So that, in other words, there's a cycling between the living and the dead, which is seen as a cycling between the human and animal worlds. And consequently, we can use animals as mediators. So that, for instance, one of the things that if you imagine the living and the dead as the world of humans and gods or spirits, then it may be useful and necessary to tap into the power of gods and spirits. And gods and spirits have to be radically different from us, otherwise they wouldn't be any use. And one of the ways that we do that is by sacrifice. And what we're doing in sacrifice is using animals both as metaphors of ourselves, they are like us, but also metonyms of ourselves, they are part of us. So that the logic of sacrifice is to take an animal, a domestic animal, with whom you yourself are identified. It's rather inconvenient to kill yourself. If you need to be in the world of the dead to contact gods and spirits, it's problematic to kill yourself. But if you identify yourself with an animal, you can then kill an animal and use the death of that animal as a device to bridge the gap between the living and the dead. And if you think about the story of Abraham and Isaac and the ram in the thicket, you'll see this very clearly. God tells Abraham to sacrifice, to kill his son, Isaac. So the initial sacrifice is that the identity between the victim and the donor of the sacrifice is that of father to son. And he's about to do this, but at the last minute, miraculously, there's a ram in the thicket, and he kills the ram instead of his son. But the logic of the story is that the ram is identified with Isaac, who is identified with Abraham. So that metaphorically, at least, this is a self-sacrifice in order to come closer to God. Okay, so that's just to give you some, that's just simply to stress that when we think animals, we think about them in two ways. Either that they are like us, and or that they are part of us, an extension of us. Now I want, for the rest of this lecture, really to do two things. Firstly, to look at some classic anthropological treatments of animal symbolism in the context of what is called totemism. And secondly, to look at some of the ways in which the symbolic uses and values of animals change in different contexts. So I want to start in the tribal world and then shift into the Western industrial world and explore some of the ways that there are both continuities and differences between the two. And my point there is that the way that, that to some extent the symbolic uses vary according to the way of life, scale and complexity, etc., of different societies. So let's begin with totemism. What totemism is understood to be is a relationship between, typically, a relationship between an animal species and a human group such as a clan or lineage. And this was the, it's found all over Australia, but the word comes actually from North American Indians, so it's also found in Aboriginal North America. Now in the 19th century, Victorian gentlemen and ladies who were very secure or thought they were very secure in their own position assumed that this idea that we find in some societies, that people say that we have a special relationship to an animal species, we are the bears or we are the kangaroos, etc. This was, we are descended from a bear or kangaroo ancestor. This sort of idea was taken as absolute demonstration that savages were incapable of distinguishing between themselves and animals, that they had a fuzzy, bad way of thinking, and that it followed, in a sense, that if animals are savage, then obviously savages were animals. So that this mode of thinking was taken as proof that savages were not much different from animals, because they couldn't see the basic distinction which was the mark of civilization, the distinction between man and animal. By the time of Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown in the 20s and 30s, we get a quite different view, which is that it's not that people are stupid, but they are concerned with practical matters. So that Malinowski's thesis, in brief, is that, and Radcliffe Brown's, was that totemic animals were food animals, and the reason why clans and social groups gave importance to animals or gave symbolic value to them was basically because the symbolic value reflected the practical utility. To sum it up, for Malinowski then, animals are simply good to think, good to eat. Now, what Durkheim did was to criticize this point, and Durkheim arrived at the idea that, in fact, the system of totemism was the first example of religious thinking. So Durkheim's thesis was basically as follows, that we have that society and the social order is the given natural experience, that human beings live in societies and that it is the experience of society that gives people the first idea of how to classify nature. So that he argues that it is the reason why we talk, for instance, of animals as in kingdoms, plant kingdoms, in genuses, genera, etc., that we families of animals, is that we are taking the ideas that we know about in society and imposing them upon the natural world. So that for Durkheim, it was from society that we got our mode of classification. So that Durkheim says, well, it's because we are divided into social groups that we therefore divide the animal world into, by analogy, into social groups. It's because our life consists of feasts, holidays, rituals, and ordinary life that we get our first idea of time. It's because our social world is divided between sacred spaces and ordinary places that we get the idea of the classification of space. So that for Durkheim, it was the social order that gave rise to the basic categories of human thought. And his particular example of this, or one of his particular examples, was animals, that we classify animals according to a logic which is derived from our social experience. Now, if you follow this, it's logical, it follows naturally from this, that Durkheim, the implications of Durkheim's idea is one of extreme cultural relativism, because if it's true that the very categories of thought come from our experience of society, then it also follows that because there are all sorts of different social arrangements, then all the people in the world ought to have different categories of thought. So that Durkheim, here in Durkheim's thesis, this is part of his thesis about animal relations with animals, there is an extreme relativistic position, and this was exactly what I was talking about in terms of time. I gave you another example of an extreme relativistic position. But in Durkheim's case, this relativism is even more absolute, because if you think about it, if it was really true that every single society in the world, if their basic categories of time, space, number, etc., were different from each other, it's very hard to imagine how any kind of intercultural communication would be possible. And I will come back to why it's for that reason that Levi-Strauss and others have tried to critique Durkheim's ideas. The second bit of Durkheim's thesis about totemism was that totemism wasn't a mistaken idea that animal species, it wasn't the idea that people were incapable of distinguishing between animals and themselves, nor was it a matter of utility. What Durkheim argued was that the animal species selected as totems were actually being used as symbols. It wasn't anything special about the animals themselves that it wasn't that there was anything special about bears or kangaroos or whatever totem you wanted to have. The animals were taken as arbitrary symbols of the group, so that by worshipping animal species, what these tribal societies in Australia were doing was effectively worshipping their own social order, so that the animal was a symbol of the social order. What Durkheim is saying is essentially that in just the same way that in Britain, the Queen is to some extent sacred and stands for the social order, so in these tribals, or in the states, in the United States, the flag, the stars and stripes, is sacred and stands for the social order. It's fairly arbitrary what the flag looks like. We can have all sorts of different people sacralize their flags. So that what Durkheim is arguing is that animal species serve as emblems for social units, and that the reason the animals become sacred is nothing to do with their own utility, but because they stand as symbols of society. That really it's that their symbolic function which gives them their sacredness. In other words, they represent central values. Now, what Levi-Strauss did was really to turn Durkheim upside down, and said that Durkheim had an interesting idea. Durkheim was right that people were indeed making an analogy between social classifications and natural classifications, but actually it was operating the other way around. It wasn't that people were classifying animals according to a social logic. What they were doing was actually perceiving the differences in the animal world as a ready-made way of thinking about differences in the social world. In just the same way as that I've talked about college scarves as being the system of differences in the colour world, which is being used as a symbol for a systemic difference between colleges. So Levi-Strauss is saying that animals can be used in the same way. And I'm now going to give you an example from where I work in Amazonia, which shows you how this actually operates in practice. I work with some people, it doesn't really matter, I work with some people called the Barasana, who have neighbors called the Tatuyo and Bara. So, and each of these groups is that each group speaks a different language, and they're intermarrying groups. That's what exogamic means. They swap wives between each other. Now, the Barasana say that they are descended from somebody called Earth Anaconda, Yeba Menihino. And they say that the Tatuyo, their affines, their neighbors and affines, are descended from Sky Anaconda, Umuanihino. And their other neighbors, the Bara, are descended from Water Anaconda. So these are the ancestors of these three groups. Now you can see already that we've got a system of sky, earth, and water. But then they will tell you that actually Sky Anaconda is... So here we've got Water Anaconda is actually an anaconda, and there's a whole mass of anacondas all curled up together. They will tell you that Earth Anaconda is a jaguar and that Sky Anaconda is a harpy eagle. So here we have a harpy eagle. So what you can see here is that what they're saying is that this set of differences, these people are all human beings who belong in a marriage system, but they're all different. Their ancestors are all anacondas, which means powerful transformative beings, who are represented in the natural world by harpy eagles, jaguars, and anacondas. So that they're making a parallel system, that the difference between us, we're all humans, but we intermarry, when that's like the difference between different animal species. So what Levi-Strauss, using this kind of example, came up with was the idea that animals are not, it wasn't Durkheim and Malinowski, it wasn't that animals were good to eat, that he said that they were good to think with. They were being used as a mode of thinking. And that this mode of thinking wasn't, as Durkheim had supposed, something peculiar to tribal societies, because we all do it. In other words, stripped down behind the differences, you can see that the way this operates is not much different from the way that your college scarves operate too. So that whereas Durkheim had thought of totemism as a system of primitive tribal religion, Levi-Strauss is saying it's not that at all. It's a modality of thinking. Well, that's all very well, but Durkheim had something important to say, which was that human beings give symbolic significance, they give values to animal species that you don't normally in your day-to-day life get very excited about whether your college scarf trails in the mud, but in Australia and in Aboriginal North America, people act with regard to animal species with a great deal of reverence and respect. In other words, Levi-Strauss's ideas are much too cerebral and abstract. They strip out quite a lot of what's going on. They strip out attitudes and values. Durkheim had emphasized that the relationship between animal, the totemic relationship was not simply one of thinking, but also one of reverence and respect, i.e. sacredness. And this is a question which was taken up by Mary Douglas, in her book Purity and Danger and in various other animals, Mary Douglas asks the question, why are, if she follows Levi-Strauss in saying that animals are good to think with, but asks the question, why do some animals get a special ritual status? In other words, why are some animals better to think with than others? Not all animals are treated as equal. And her answer is that she says that Levi-Strauss is right, that animal taxonomies, the way people classify animals, does indeed reflect society and social value. Sorry, it does indeed reflect social arrangements, but it also reflects ideas about morality and marriage rules, etc., and ideas of identity. So what she argues is that there's an analogy drawn between different animal species and different human groupings. And she argues that what is happening is that societies, or certain societies in the world, they like to imagine that just as they are like discrete cultures or societies, just as animals are discrete or seem to come as discrete species or classes, so human beings, we would like to think, come as discrete classes and species. So in a tidy world, the human system and the animal system would match up. We are different from our neighbors, just like this kind of animal is different from that kind of animal. But she argues that the trouble is that there are some kinds of animals which muck up, which seem to blur the tidy distinctions between different animal classes. And if that is the case, then that might imply that these tidy distinctions between human groups are also blurred. And she gives us an example. She takes the chapters of Leviticus in the Bible and asks, what is it in common? The Leviticus lists a whole series of different animals which are taboo and inedible. And she asks the question, well, what is it that these animals have in common? It's a very bizarre list if you look at it. And her argument is that the animals that are tabooed in Leviticus are animals which are in some sense anomalous or ambiguous animals. So that, for instance, fish, the world is divided into things which live on land, sky, and water, and things which go between categories are seen as dangerous and taboo. She also takes the example, this particular example of why is it that the pig is particularly reviled in this system. And her argument is that the pig blurs tidy. The first thing about the pig is that it blurs tidy categories. And the categories, her argument is that the ancient Israelites' domestic animals had the following, that the domestic animals, goats and sheep and cattle, had cloven hooves and chewed the cud. So that good animals, proper animals, are like that. And the problem with the pig is that it is not a proper animal because it has cloven hooves but doesn't chew the cud. And then she points out that the camel and the hyrax are also tabooed for the same reason, because the camel doesn't have cloven hooves. The camel and hyrax are the opposite of the pig. They do chew the cud, but they don't have they don't have cloven hooves. So that, in short, all of these animals are imperfect animals. And she argues then that we could see the world as, in a sense, there are two modalities of dealing with this problem of anomalous animals. On the one hand, there are societies who like to see themselves as set apart, internally whole and different from their neighbors. Societies of that kind are likely to see anomalous animals as dangerous and threatening, because they imply that the distinctions between social groups are not as neat as they should be. There are other societies who go in the opposite direction, who revere and celebrate animals which are boundary crossers, because they themselves are interested in systems of exchange. And one of the things that the people here are interested in, the fact is that these animals are all boundary crossers. They emphasize all the time that these are animals which cross between spatial layers, and that's reflected in the fact that in one sense they're deemed all to be anacondas. So here we have a set of people who give positive social value to mediating animals, and in the Leviticus system, mediating or anomalous animals are given a negative social status. Well, so those are two examples, or that's a set of examples of how people have tried to deal with this issue of totemism. And it's a story from starting with the idea of savage confusion of categories through to the idea of a first religion, through to the idea of a system of thinking, through to the idea of, yes, but why is it that people give, why do people either reject particular animals, give them negative status, or give them positive status? Now, if we look at what happens in these cases, we get a relatively tidy set of symbolic systems operating. If we look at what happens in the modern world, we see some very important changes. With 19th century industrialization, we get a radical rupture, except in those people who remain farmers, and even they become typically industrialized. We get a radical rupture between human beings and animals. Animals are pushed to the margins of productive life and also pushed to the margins of our ordinary city life, that there are the animals are out in the country. And so in other words, we get, at the same time that in one sense we remove animals from our lives and become alienated from animal lives, we see two other things happening. The first one is that we begin to sentimentalize animals, that it's precisely coincidentally with this process of removing animals from our productive experience that we begin both to sentimentalize animals, so that if you read Hugh Thomas's book Man and the Natural World, you will see that the rise of the kind of romanticized nature corresponds exactly to the process of industrialization. And that the other point we see is that as we remove animals from our practical daily experience, we begin to see a rise in a scientific attitude to animals. And so that animals, on the one hand, cease to be part of us physically and emotionally, and become kind of soulless machines, and we start getting this idea of the distinction between humans and animals is like the distinction between mind and body, etc. We get a sort of radical separation between man and nature, and at the same time, the idea that we can reflect upon nature in a scientific way. So that we get the rise of Linnaean taxonomy in natural history books. But when we look at the rise of Linnaean taxonomy in natural history books, we see that actually animals, that the old ideas, that ideas which we think of as somewhat primitive, come back to haunt our modern thinking. If you look, for instance, at Linnaeus's original books, or Buffon, who was a French naturalist working at roughly the same time, you will see that both of them put tribal peoples as part of their schema. So that for both Linnaeus and Buffon, we still use Linnaeus's basic classification, but we don't any longer have in our picture books of the animal world people from the Congo pygmies and Australian Aborigines. Linnaeus also, interestingly, his whole enterprise reflected his own social background. So that on the one hand there was the prestige of learning, but also Linnaeus's obsession with taxonomy and classification reflects the place from which Linnaeus came from, Uppsala in Sweden. And if you go to Uppsala, you will see very quickly that it's a very tidy place. And Linnaeus's garden, you can still see it, is all very tidy. So Linnaeus was a man obsessed with social position and tidiness in his own world. And we can begin to see that if we look at Linnaeus's taxonomy from an anthropological perspective, we begin to see that actually it's not unlike the kind of folk taxonomies or tribal unlettered taxonomies that I've been talking about. In other words, that if tribal ways of thinking about animals also can reflect their social concerns, so also does Linnaeus's taxonomy. So that we find that Linnaeus is actually using his own social experience to construct the first scientific taxonomy, so that he gets a vegetable kingdom divided into tribes and nations. And these tribes and nations get very sociologically loaded titles. So here is Linnaeus on grasses. Linnaeus says the grasses, well, these are plebeians. The more they're taxed and trod upon, the more they multiply. And lilies, he says, well, lilies are patricians. Lilies are kind of nice people. Lilies amuse the eye and adorn the vegetable kingdom with the splendor of their courts. And what are funguses? Well, funguses are vagabonds, barbarous, naked, putrescent, rapacious, voracious creatures. Now, here you so that Linnaeus, the champion of science and the start of the whole revolution in biological taxonomies, you can see very clearly that what he's doing is putting back into his scientific ideas a whole lot of ideas which are nothing to do with science at all, but which are derived from his own social experience. Now, at the same time, so on the one hand, we get the rise of scientific classifications of animals, which turn out to be imbued with a whole lot of models which are coming back into science, where they don't belong, models from social experience. And at the same time, we get a sentimental shift about animals, so that we get an urban bourgeois emphasis on kindness to animals, and so that we get the rise of, for instance, the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And again, we see that the RSPCA, if we look at the history of the RSPCA, that we see that it has a hidden agenda of politics and class. So that the RSPCA was very, very, very anti-bull baiting, bear baiting, cockfighting, etc. All of these things, which were lower class pastimes, were attacked and eradicated, but not the upper class pastimes of fox hunting, etc. So that it took a very, very long time, in fact, until really in the last 10 or 15 years, that the class issues of animal rights, etc., began to fully work them through the system. And also, you've seen recently, it's been only very recently has Britain finally decided that the threat of rabies is perhaps not quite so awful as people used to pretend. And only very recently have they removed these terrible, frightening posters about rabid dogs coming in from the continent, which might threaten our British integrity. So that again, we see that what looks like a rational campaign to protect us from rabies may have another political message. And we can see also, of course, that what is happening today over the Countryside Alliance and the Labour Party's attack on fox hunting is also politically loaded in the same way. We also get the rise of an intimacy, a different kind of intimacy between humans and animals. So that it's as we get an alienation of animals as productive, part of our normal productive life, as creatures we rear to eat, to use in production, etc. Pets, now we get the rise of non-productive pet keeping, which corresponds to this shift in industrialization and alienation from animals. So that domestic animals now become accessories or mirrors to their owners in the way that I suggested right at the start. We also get a moral hierarchy of animals, which is quite interesting. And again, we see this around us all the time, but we're not necessarily aware of it. Obviously, there's a moral hierarchy between dogs, cats, and horses versus vermin. And of course, different societies have different takes on this. The English have the role of horses in English thinking is rather different from the role of horses in French thinking. English people are horrified by the idea of eating horses, the French not so. Birds have a very peculiar status in all this. Birds turn out as a kind of super bourgeois symbol. If you go into heifers and just look at, if you go into the natural history section, you will notice a enormously disproportionate, the bird section, the ornithology section, is a massive, huge set of cases, far more than now than the anthropology section. The bird section is very, very big indeed. You can buy a book on the domestic life of the robin, you know, a monograph on this kind of owl and that kind of owl. If you look at the section on fishes, there's quite a lot on koi carp, but the fact that we actually, most human beings rely on fishes for their basic subsistence is certainly not reflected in the attention we give to fishes in Heffer's bookshop. Birds are nice creatures. They're free, they're clean, they make homes. Most of them are monogamous. And we think they're very nice in England. We don't like eating little birds. The French are again different here. But of course, not all birds are equal. Some of them are very wicked. There's been a lot of stuff in the press at the moment about killing magpies. Magpies are naughty birds. They don't do things. There are magpies and cuckoos and sparrows. Sparrows have got a different press, but here is Linnaeus on sparrows. Sparrows are working class, the Irishmen of birds, with their noise and their squabbles, their boldness and their ubiquity. So that in the old days, sparrows were kind of nasty, lower class creatures, and people didn't like sparrows, they didn't look at sparrows, but now the trouble is sparrows are disappearing, so people have begun to protect them. And we also get, the next thing that we find is that animals become moral examples, and this takes me back to where I started from, which is, what's happened to my slide? I've lost it. Yeah, here we are. Animals as moral examples. So that animals figure quite strongly in our moralistic thinking about the way societies should operate. So that sex education, until very recently, wasn't done through human beings at all, but was done quite literally. We talked about it as the birds and the bees, and those two, the two animals chosen, were not at random. Birds are nice creatures, and bees are very good too, because bees are a symbol of industriousness, so that's what you two should be. You should be nice and industrious. So, dear, if you want to know about how people work, well, they work like birds and bees. And here we have the same, this is an example from a Swedish book, the idea that animals live in happy families just like we do. So that here are these children looking at father sheep, mother sheep, and little baby sheep. So that, in other words, we can use non-human metaphors to avoid the unmentionable. So to sum up, what I've been trying to say is that animals are a central feature of our lives for all sorts of different ways, not simply because of their practical utility, but because all the time and in all sorts of very, very different ways, we think animals. Our language is full of animal metaphors. We are surrounded by animals, and we're surrounded by animal symbols, and that is true wherever you go in the world. But there are both continuities and differences. There are some major differences between the way we think animals and tribal people think animals. If you are squeamish and are sentimental about animals, 2 years in the Amazon will really turn your stomach when you're handed pieces of roast smoked monkey, sort of little wizened hands, and you're told to eat that, or told to eat monkey brains. So on the one hand, and people are horrifically cruel to animals, so that there is no sentimentalization at all about animals. But on the other hand, here are people who are very worried about the consequences of eating animals, not because they love animals, but because animals are really people just like us, and if you shoot an animal, then it will do its best to shoot you back, and it'll do that by putting nasty spines and fur into your body, so that a great deal of Amerindian shamanism is about protecting people or curing people from the revenge of the animals that they have eaten. We come across the Jains, who I mentioned on Tuesday. The Jains are hyper-vegetarians, but don't get mistaken about the Jains. It's not that the Jains are super lover animal lovers at all, as the Westerners would like to imagine them. Jains are heralded as the real proper vegetarians. Actually, the Jains hate animals. And the reason that they go to such great lengths to boil their water, and some of them sweep the ground in front of their feet so they don't tread on animals, is not because they're frightened of squashing grasshoppers. It's that, how horrible to tread on such a nasty thing. So that we get different takes on animals. And what we see in our own society is, on the one hand, an alienation from animals, plus a sentimentalization of animals, plus the fact that in certain ways, these old ways, or what we think of as old ways of thinking, totemic ways of thinking, invade what we think as proper science. And I've given you the example of Linnaeus's own taxonomy and Linnaeus's writings. But if you read quite a lot of contemporary science on animals, or if you watch the animal programs on the telly, you will see that what is ostensibly science is shot through with all sorts of anthropomorphic thinking. Thank you.